Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, we're going to travel back in time a little bit to get an idea of how daily life was in rural Minnesota during an age when life moved at a slightly different speed. I'm joined today by Florence Griffin, who, at 90 years old now, has spent a majority of her life living in rural central Minnesota. Over the years of growing up on a farm, getting her nursing degree, and raising a large family with her now-deceased husband, Dr. Dick Griffin, Florence has seen a good number of things change over the last 90 years, as many of the stories that she'll be telling us over the next half hour or so will clearly demonstrate. However, before we get into her recollections of life on the farm in the winter and how school was taught and how community came together for one another during the Depression, I'd just like to say that Florence had much more to say than would fit into a half-hour news feature. So in the podcast of this installment of the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, I've included the complete interview where you'll find much more information about life in Minnesota and how it's changed over the years. And that can be found at www.kvsc.org under the podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota link. And now, Florence Griffin, about how her father made the decision to bring the family to central Minnesota almost 90 years ago.
What brought you to central Minnesota, and when, and how farm life has changed as you know it?
Certainly. My name is Florence Griffin. My maiden name was Florence Herbert. My father was Bohemian, and my mother was German. When my dad and mom were married, they were both living in Iowa City, and my dad was a bricklayer and built roads. He was a foreman on a bricklaying company. It's called Corbin, for anybody who might know that name.
Yeah, those roads are still there, too.
Those are. Yeah. Those are still there. And it was interesting for me because I was living in Iowa for just a short time when my parents moved back to Iowa. So I began my nurse's training in Iowa City. And here are the streets that my father laid, still in operation. The bricks are still there. But he decided that after he was married and had a daughter, that he didn't like to be gone, because he'd be gone for a week at a time at another city and laying bricks and so forth. So he decided the best way to be a family would be to live on a farm. Never farmed before, never lived on a farm or anything. So it took a lot of courage to do that. His brother was an engineer on a railroad that went from Cedar Rapids to Minneapolis, and then he caught a train there and went as far west as the railroad went. And he stopped at Graceville. That's as far as the train went. And then that's almost into South Dakota. It's very close to South Dakota. So they, to show how farming has changed, for instance, you could never do that now because farming is so complicated. But all he needed to do was build a building where he and his wife and children could live while he built a house and a barn, and he had the help of all of his neighbors to do that. It was like a commune almost, like they were so cooperative. They lived in the granary for a number of years, and my dad ordered horses, two mules, two cows, two sheep, and I'm not sure of anything else, but all from Sears Roebuck. And it was sent out on the train, and they picked it up in Graceville and brought them out to the farm.
Yeah, it's kind of like the original Sears Roebuck catalogs that, you know, well, I guess we still kind of have those.
Of course you do. Yeah. And you have catalog stores. Mm-hmm. But they just about handled anything. I know I've talked with my dad, and he said he could have had all of the lumber sent out for his house by ordering it from Sears Roebuck. Can you imagine that?
Yeah. Delivering a house. Yeah.
Delivering a house.
Well, nowadays they kind of, you can, I guess there's a 3D printer that will print a house for you.
Right, so, right. And there's a lot of prefab houses and so forth. But anyway, to show you how farming and living has changed, I grew up in a house that had no electricity, no telephone, no running water, and a cook stove, and a wood stove to heat the house. Our upstairs, now keep thinking that we live in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Our upstairs had bare rafters. There was no insulation in the upstairs roof at all. We weren't cold. We slept between two big feather beds. So it was just like camping, but we'd gather our clothes up and hurry down by the wood stove to dress in the morning because it was so cold up there. When we wake up, we'd have frost on the blankets where we breathed during the night. We didn't feel deprived or anything because everybody else was living under the same conditions. We didn't know we were poor because we had enough to eat. We had loving parents. We had a roof over our head. And everyone was kind of in the same boat. This is during the Depression, during the drought. There were a lot of chores to do on the farm. We each knew what we had to do, and we would switch jobs once a month. One time, we'd be in charge of the chickens. So we'd have to make sure that we gathered the eggs, we fed them, we cleaned their brooder house. And also, when we hatched the chickens in the spring, we'd have to make room in our dining room for the incubators. And if you were on chicken duty, you had to turn the eggs twice a day. And we had to put white gloves on, I remember that, because the oil in our hands would have done something with the ability of the shells to allow oxygen to go into the chicken. But oh, what fun it was when they started breaking their shells in the spring, trying to come out of their shell, and we'd have to pick them up and put them in a nice warm box with probably about a half a dozen canning jars full of hot water in there and put a towel or a blanket over the top of the box to keep them warm.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it also, that collective nature, what you were talking about waking up with frost on the sheets, on the blankets, and, you know, nobody considered themselves poor or, you know, yeah, underprivileged or anything, because everyone around the community this is how people are living. And, you know, nice big family, and everybody, there's all sorts of big families around, and everyone is, you know, making do. It's just how life is. So there's that, there's no defining anything, you know, along those economic lines. It's how we existed, you know, just as humans. You know, we didn't have didn't have cable TV, internet, you know, fancy games. You made up your own entertainment as you went, and there you go.
Some of the things we did for entertainment were tell progressive stories. One person would start the story, and they'd have a certain amount of time, say 5 minutes, to tell their part of the story. Then we'd pass it on to the next person, and they'd have to pick up the story there and put their contribution in there. And we played a lot of charades. We played hide and go seek. We played numerous games of hide and seek and rolling a tire rim down the driveway with a stick. That was a great thing to do. We have contests. We had a lot of house parties where we would, nobody had thought of anything, you know, the whole family went. So there was no babysitting at the house parties. Sometimes we'd dance, sometimes we'd play music. My dad played the fiddle. His dad was a concert cello and violin player in Iowa City, and that's where he had learned to play the violin. The kids would go to sleep if we had the dance at the schoolhouse, for instance. The kids would go to sleep, and all the coats were piled on the floor in one corner, and they'd just go out, climb in on the coats, and everybody'd sort them all out when they were ready to go home and take them home, wake them up and take them home. We'd have house parties just going to another person's home. And I remember one family had a player piano, and we would play that piano at the loudest we could play it. Nobody paid any attention to us kids. As long as they were playing cards and we didn't bother them, that was okay. They played cards. Let me tell you a little bit about our school. I went to a country school. We had all 8 grades in one room at first. But as the population in the area increased, a new school room or a new school house had to be built. So we had two rooms. We had the first five grades in the one room and five, sixth, seventh, eighth in the other room. So we had two teachers. It was a big change when I went to Graceville for high school because there were 40 kids in my class, and we had to change teachers and go to different rooms, and it was a big adjustment to make. But I think it's a good concept to have students of different ages together. It teaches them that they can get along. Different age groups can get along. I know when we chose our teams in school, we'd have to take an upperclassman and then a lowerclassman as choices. So we had a mixture of older kids and real young kids. So there was no peer group. We also acted out a lot of the history. We had history and literature together, and we had a big room that was full of costumes, and we'd dress up at the period of history that we were studying about and act everything out. And it stuck with us really very well. The teachers were good. They were strict disciplinarians. I remember that my brother had a yardstick broken over his back one time because he was doing something that he shouldn't be doing. And when the teacher hit him, she hit a button on the back of his overalls, and half of the yardstick flew up to the rafters in the schoolhouse that were open. And he later, probably 30 years later, bought that old schoolhouse for an extra granary on his farm. And he thought, I wonder if that's still up there. So he looked, and sure enough, it was still up there, the other half of the yardstick. We nice. Had one teacher that was very short, and she used to stand on the desk to teach because she had some 7th and 8th grade boys in that class that were big men by that time. She felt like if she was up higher than them, they would have more respect for her. But one of the boys was misbehaving, so she had him lie down on the ground, and she continued her class while she stood on his head. Well, he never misbehaved again. So that wouldn't be done today. No,
probably not. But nonetheless, it seems effective. I don't know.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today, I'm sitting down with Florence Griffin, who, at 90 years old, has had a considerable number of life experiences on the farm and out in the country here in central Minnesota. And as we charge headlong into the 21st century, it's nice to look back, not even 100 years ago into the 20th century, to see how life has changed and also stayed the same. Once again, for the complete unabridged interview, you'll be able to find that on our website at kvsc.org under the podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota link. And now we rejoin Florence as she tells us how she met her husband, Dr. Dick Griffin, and how the practice of rural medicine has changed over the years as well.
Yeah. Well, I met my husband when I was in nurse's training, and he was in medical school, and he was working for his room and board at the hospital where I trained. So I got to know him quite well, and I worked with him for probably a year and a half before I ever even thought about dating him. He was very shy. People who knew him later in life would have a hard time recognizing that.
Yeah, that's about what I was going to say. He didn't seem too shy to me when I met him those few times.
But his mother had died when he was 12, and she'd been sick probably 4 years before that, and unable to live at home, she stayed with her family, and there were five boys in Dick's family, no girls, and their household was very noisy, and she couldn't tolerate the noise. So he did not have as good a home life as I did. They had a lot more money than we did, but that isn't everything, and we've always recognized that fact. I guess the first time I even thought about dating Dick was one time when I had gone out to a nightclub that the nurses were not supposed to go to.
It is Iowa City, after all.
In Iowa City. Yeah. And what was he doing? He was standing on top of a table leading everybody that was there in Alouette. And I thought, this guy's got a little life in him. I always respected the care he gave his patients. You get to know somebody really well when you work with them. I had another little barrier, and that was that I had accepted a ring from a young man who lived near me in Iowa City, or in Richmond, or Riverside, Iowa. That's where we lived when for the couple of years that my parents lived down there, before he went into the service. And I had to write this Dear John letter that I didn't think was very much fun at all when he was in Italy. So I think my lesson there is to not make those life decisions when you're too young or when you're upset or maybe any other time. So it's a good thing for you young people to think about, what's fair. You know, that if you can say, be kind and think of what's fair, you've got it made.
So then you guys got married and then just moved up here? Or how did you guys ended up settling just western Stearns County eventually? Wasn't that right?
Well, Stearns County comes very close to us. It comes into the edge of Bruton, and we're only 15 miles from Bruton.
That's right. That's right.
So we're in Gilchrist Township in Pope County. That's where we raised our family. Oh, I should tell you that while he was in the service, he was in charge of Rommel's prisoners that were taken in Northern Africa. And they were such gentlemen. They were very well treated. I think we did a lot of good as ambassadors when those troops returned to Germany. They were gentlemen. They were came to sick call and very responsible, and I can't say enough about them. And then when he came out of service, he worked for Dr. Oliver in Graceville for a year. That was a big medical center. There were five doctors who worked there. It's well known in western Minnesota as a good clinic and good doctors and good service to people. So he learned there how to set up his office. And it's interesting to me that the main way they found areas that needed a doctor and would be a good place to practice was through the drug salesmen. They made the route, and they knew where they needed doctors. Or the drug salesman told Dick that there was an opening in Benson that he thought would be good. There was an opening in Rush City that he thought would be good, and also one in Sisseton, South Dakota. So I told him, knowing Sisseton quite well, and it's kind of a wild town at that time, I said, well, if you're going to Sisseton, I think you'll have to go alone. So already we had a good partnership.
So what are some of the other differences that you've noticed changing just over the years, either just farming or just, you know, country life, if you will? You know, because we kind of touched on quite a few things, but there's definitely, today is a very different world.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I'd bring up is how farm life has changed. It takes a lot more capital now to begin farming than it did when my father, for instance, began farming, or my brother when he began farming. Kids on the farm don't have the chores that they used to have to do that taught them responsibility. They taught them how to work, because the machinery that's used for farming now is so expensive. You just couldn't turn it over to a young kid like you could a team of horses and a hay rake. So not only is it more expensive to start farming now, it's one of those combines now will cost as much as we paid for our house in Benson, which was $125,000. Well, you couldn't build a house. We had a five-bedroom brick house on the golf course in Benson, and that's what our house cost when we built it in 1958. So not only is it more expensive, but it's difficult to find enough easy chores for farm kids to do anymore. nobody raises chickens anymore, or hardly any. But the people right around where I live in Pope County are pretty old-fashioned when you think about their habits. They are subsistence farmers. They don't understand all of these farm programs because they benefit people who own big farms. They don't benefit the small farmer very much. I know I have a couple of farmer friends who say he thinks all of the subsidies should be taken away because the only people that are benefiting from it are investors who have bought a farm, and a lot of them are included in our representatives and senators who have bought farms, and they're the ones who are benefiting from the subsidy programs. All of these farmers are very quick to come to help somebody. Now, that's another point that I think is unusual about the area that I live in. They always have time to stop and visit. They come and check on me many times, either by phone or they stop in or have coffee, and sometimes that entails an hour to just have coffee. So it's kind of a different area. I love it. I feel safe out there. I don't know if I mentioned that I'm 90 years old. Well, really 90 and a half now. And I've seen not that much change in the way people treat each other there. There's a lot of young people that have moved to Minneapolis or because that's where the jobs are. I thought that when computers came to be so popular and every home has them, that there would be more employment out in the rural areas because people can work from their computers. And some of them do. A lot of the kids take classes on their computers, and so things are changing all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with the that's something I experienced as a teacher, the different resources that are available. You can basically take classes online at MIT now. Mm-hmm. Or you can do it for free. You don't get the actual credit, but you've got access to that knowledge, that information, mm-hmm. and that's definitely something different. Yeah, it is kind of a strange dynamic. You know, still, people go to the cities to work. Well, I think people do that for a while, and then they decide, you know, I think it's nicer out here, where it's quieter.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. There's a movement back to the rural areas. And I like to see that. I like to see that.
Well, anything else you'd like to toss in there real quick? Anything else you'd like to say about just anything?
Well, this is kind of an interesting note from my childhood. Mm-hmm. We lived on a farm that had a creek running through it. And when the ice would freeze on the creek, we had one pair of clamp-on skates. And they were pretty big size, so most of us were just skating with our shoes or boots on. My mom and dad liked to fish a lot. And so many times we'd come home from school and we'd have a note on the table said, "Mom and Dad are fishing. Do the chores and start supper." So we were glad that they were doing something fun because they both worked so hard. Oh, I have a lot. Anytime you live to be 90, you have a lot of memories. And I do have to tell you that it was an adjustment for me to be without my husband. But I can't feel sad. We had a wonderful marriage. We were married almost 66 years when he died at 93. He was able to retire out at the farm, which he loved, and he had kind of an equal divide in his life. He had preparation for his lifetime work. The first 30 years, he was 27 when he graduated from medical school. Then he practiced medicine for 30 years, and then he was retired for 30 years. What better life can you have?
Yeah. That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. So I can't feel sad, and I have a lot of wonderful memories. I get lonesome, but I don't feel sad.
Well, you can just come and visit your kids.
I did lose my oldest son this year in January, and with no preparation for his death. It had a sudden death, died in his sleep, and that has been much more difficult to deal with because he was 67, I think, at the time, but just doing so many fun things for him. He was a botany major, and he was developing new fruits, doing a lot of grafting and using signwood from Finland and Alaska and all over the world to make a winter hardy peach. And he was just about there. In fact, he has a winter hardy peach that not very good to eat, but it makes wonderful sauce and good jam and wonderful pie. So that was a tragic thing for him to spend so many years doing that. Anyway, we deal with what we're dealt. And I still have God as my partner. I won't ever have to do without him.
And you've been listening to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. We're in today's installment. We've been talking with Florence Griffin, who has been recounting how life and times have changed within rural Minnesota during her 90 years on the planet. During the course of our interview, it became very apparent that she had much more to say than would simply fit within a half-hour news feature. So the complete unabridged interview can be found online on our website at kvsc.org under the podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota link. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack. And if you've got stories about how life has changed in Minnesota over the years and you'd like to share them, you can get a hold of us by sending an email to info@kvsc.org. Just mention that you've got an untold story that you'd like to tell. This program was made possible through support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPRS. Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.